Good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
How are you all doing tonight? I hope you're doing well. It's good to see you. Tonight, we get to delve into C.S. Lewis, and particularly, we get to delve into the Chronicles of Narnia, which I am very excited about. Last week, we had a really cool opportunity to look at C.S. Lewis's works in terms of his nonfiction, a lot of his apologetics in particular. We read through a little bit of Mere Christianity, which was fantastic. I hope you guys were blessed by that and have been blessed by it if you've gotten to start looking into it any further. Tonight, we are going to get to look at, we've looked at Lewis's kind of rational side. Even though Lewis does this great job of bringing rationality into a new picture for us that's easy to understand, and now we get to kind of look at Lewis in an imaginative side, which I'm very excited about. But before we do that, I want to give you guys, I know you've had a chance to talk a little bit already, but I want to give you a chance to introduce yourselves, but also to ask yourselves this question. What is or was your favorite story? Now, not everybody necessarily loved to read as much as I did when I was a kid. I was the kid who, like, my parents had to come in and take the flashlight from underneath the covers and everything, or else I wouldn't go to bed. But not everybody loved reading as much as I did. But I think story, in some form or fashion, is a primary part of what it means to be human, right? There's a reason that stories, going back to the very beginning of humanity, whether that be oral storytelling or movies or books or whatever else, story has been a part of our history as far as we can remember. And so I think this is a question that is important for us to ask, is what stories draw us to them and why? So that's the question I want you to kind of ask yourselves and discuss for just a couple minutes as we get started here. What is or was your favorite story and why? Go ahead. Yeah. All right, well, we have a lot to get through today, but I think for me, when I start thinking about this question, one of the things that I want us to be thinking about is, what is it about the stories that draws us in? Maybe it's just this world that we fall in love with. Maybe it's a particular character that we just enjoy spending time with, being in the presence of in some form or fashion. Or maybe it's the narrative itself, right? It's the story that kind of draws us in, and we just need to find out what happens next. But whatever it is, there's always some part of this story that draws us in, that keeps us going, that keeps us coming back to it, keeps us drawing from the well even more. And so I think all of us have some of those stories, and maybe it's a real story. Maybe it's like, you know, the storytelling of your family growing up that you enjoyed, or maybe it's it's history. It's the story of history, this like real story that pulled you in. Or maybe it's just these fictional imaginative worlds. But whatever it is, there's something special about stories. And Lewis, we talked about this last week, Lewis has this great strength of bringing abstract truth into pictures that are easy for us to digest. So he would use pictures and stories and analogies to do this. So when we think about, now we start thinking about fictional stories versus Mere Christianity or something like that. Now we see him using those same principles, but at a much larger scale, right? Lewis is bringing profound truth about our reality and helping us see it in brighter and fuller ways by placing them in these new imaginative frameworks. So here, I keep saying the word imaginative and not imaginary for a reason. Lewis was the one who made this distinction. This can be found in a letter that he wrote a few years after he wrote the first book in his space trilogy, Out of the Silent Planet. In his biography, Alistair McGrath summarizes this really well. He says, "The imaginary is something that has been falsely imagined, having no counterpart in reality. Lewis regards such uninvented reality as opening the way to delusion. But the imaginative is something produced by the human mind as it tries to respond to something greater than itself, struggling to find images adequate to the reality. The more imaginative a mythology, the greater its ability to communicate more reality to us." So Lewis's entire goal in writing stories, in writing imaginative fiction, is to communicate truth, something that is a fundamental part of our reality. And he believes that, and I do too, that through doing this in an invented world, he can draw more people in to show them this truth rather than to simply tell it. Right? There was a quote in that video we watched last week that Tim Keller said of Flannery O'Connor, who said essentially it was, if I could sum up what my story was about in one sentence, I wouldn't have had to write the whole story. Right? That you can see something fuller and more beautiful about a truth in a story than you can just by simply telling it. And so think about what we also talked about last week with Lewis in terms of his style of teaching. As a teacher, I don't know if you remember, but he would have these tutorials one-on-one with students, and he just very distinctively would ask lots of questions. He would probe and prod in order to develop the critical thinking of those students rather than simply giving them the answer. As we mentioned last time, he did not see himself as just a faucet of information which would be poured out, but more like somebody who digs a well, creating ways in which others could find the information themselves. For Lewis, stories function in much the same way. It's not simply telling people something about Christ or about reality, but giving people a new lens through which we can see the world and through which we can discover new beautiful truths for ourselves. And I think this is actually why Lewis shifts. Last week we talked about there's kind of this 15-year period from 1933, after he became a Christian, to 1947, where he writes so much of this nonfiction. And it's after this, after 1947, that he primarily makes a shift to writing a lot of his fictional works, primarily the Chronicles of Narnia. And I think part of this is because he began to realize that in order for people to really see new truth about God and about Christianity, he would be more effective if he could help people feel the effects of that rather than simply telling them some new fact. Because in a disenchanted world, the world that we live in, a modern world, a disenchanted world, people have walls up about anything that is beyond our material world. Lewis and Tolkien both believed this. Lewis and Tolkien both believed that we need enchantment. That in a Christian sense, we need a sanctified imagination. Fiction has this power to re-enchant us, to get us back to the deep human sensibility that we are part of something larger. There is something beyond us. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I listen to a lot of podcasts. If I'm driving, I'll have a podcast on. If I'm doing some menial work, I'll have headphones in and be listening to a podcast. And I listen to podcasts of like lots of random subjects. So I could have one about football or basketball. I'll listen to sermons or whatever else. I listen to one that's a basketball podcast, and there's kind of this running shtick on there. One of the guys, whenever something comes up about pop culture, about something like the Avengers or Harry Potter or video games or something like that, he'll always kind of make this like derivative comment and be like, I don't know anything about that because I'm a reality-based person. And it's just kind of this running gag that he's a reality-based person. Now, it's funny because it's their shtick, and it's funny, but it's this kind of thinking, I think, in our world that misses the point of fiction. Because it's this thinking that anything that is beyond this, anything that doesn't have to do with what we can taste, see, and feel is pointless. And fiction, particularly this like fantastical, imaginative fiction that Lewis and Tolkien did, has a completely different role. It's not just some made-up world to distract us from what is real. Lewis believed in fantasy, believed in using imagination in ways that illuminated and enhanced our world, while also reminding us that we are made for more than just this physical material world. And so today, the books that you picked up on your way in, or one of the two, are going to help us do that. In particular, we're going to be looking at Narnia, but you'll notice there was another book up there as well, the purple one there, the Perelandra. And that is one of Lewis's Space Trilogy books. Now, I need to warn you, this is number 2 in the Space Trilogy. So if you're a person who feels like you need to start at the beginning, you might have to go pick up number 1. But I actually, this is my confession, I have not read the Space Trilogy. I was waiting for like a boo or a hiss, but yeah, it's fine. I have not read the Space Trilogy. I really wanted to get it done this week, and I just started reading Narnia again and had to finish it. Yeah. So, but this came really highly recommended to me by a couple different people that if I was gonna give away one of the Space Trilogy books, it should be this one. If you like it, then I would say go back and read 1 through 3 again. I think Aaron's read them. Aaron, have you read all of them? We were talking about it the other day, so he'll probably give you a glowing, more thorough review of them if you'd like. But let's go ahead and talk then about, the other book you had, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Again, this is one, I think I said it last week, but if you don't have a copy of this in your library, you should have one. Everybody should have one. Everybody in the entire world should have one. Let's go ahead then and talk about the fiction of Lewis. We've kind of set the foundation. This is what Lewis wants to do with his fiction writing. So now let's look at what he actually did. The first bit of fiction that he writes, and I'm specifically talking about fiction in which Lewis creates a world and a narrative that isn't just an allegory. It's not just a straight one-to-one connection between Christianity and this book. So he has some books, for example, like the Screwtape Letters, right? Which the Screwtape Letters technically are fiction, right? It's giving this like fictitious narrative of one demon speaking to another. But really, the purpose is not to draw people into the world or into the narrative. The purpose is simply to communicate truth or advice or whatever you want to call it in a new framework, right? Whereas with these fictional worlds that we're going to look at that Lewis creates, these narratives that he builds, they have a different purpose, right? They have this purpose of bringing us into a new world to see our own world in a new way. So the first bit of fiction that Lewis wrote is the Space Trilogy. Now this is written for adults, whereas Narnia is written for children. So there is a bit of a difference in literary style here. And I think the big thing for here for me is that while the Space Trilogy is science fiction as opposed to a fantasy of Narnia, it's more of a fantasy-like science fiction. And one of the reasons is because science fiction was beginning to build up at the time as a very popular genre. And the reason behind that is because science had just exploded at the time. Science and technological advances were huge. So think of, let me see, I've got like, these are just a few of the scientific advances over the 20, 25 years leading up to when Lewis first wrote Out of the Silent Planet. So 20, 25 years, you've got Einstein and general relativity, there's like population genetics, and there's the discoveries of how light is made of both waves and particles, and then you start seeing how matter is made up of particles and waves, quantum mechanics, rocket ships, FM radio, they discover the neutron, nuclear fission, all these things are coming up during this time. And so science fiction starts to rise as a popular genre. But science fiction as a genre overall, the main goal or theme tended to be that science was going to save the human race, right? That this is the way that humanity is going to evolve, is going to get to the next step, is going to bring utopia. And so Lewis, what he wants to do with science fiction then is he starts to think in the late 1930s, he starts to think, okay, well, what if we use this genre to actually critique that idea, to critique the idea that science will save us? And so this is one of the central themes of Lewis's works, particularly in this Space Trilogy, that scientism and naturalism is not sufficient to satisfy or to explain reality to humanity. And so it's out of this theme that the Space Trilogy is born. Then we get the Chronicles of Narnia, published beginning in 1950, one every year. We are going to talk more about this in a few minutes. I just put that picture up there though because I really, 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 really like the original print like covers and everything else. They're very pretty. The final fictional work that Lewis wrote was Till We Have Faces. And this was written in 1956 near the, toward the end of his writing career. This is the work that Lewis actually would say is his best work. He was most proud of this work. It's a retelling of the classic Cupid and Psyche myth. It was not a huge commercial success at the time, but he, like I said, he loved it, thought it was his best work, and it was actually co-written, or at least he had a lot of help from his wife, Joy Davidman. Let's talk about Narnia. In that book you have, Perelandra, there's this encounter between these two individuals. You don't necessarily need to turn there. But there's this encounter, and it goes like this. There's one character speaking to another one, and the one character essentially is saying, well, how come we can't think about this thing that's been forbidden to us? Like, why can't we even think or talk about it? And the other character says, well, that would be a strange thing to think about what will never happen. No, in our world, we do it all the time. We put words together to mean things that have never happened and places that never were, beautiful words, well put together, and then tell them to one another. We call it stories or poetry. In that old world you spoke of, Malakandra, they did the same. It is for mirth and wonder and wisdom. Well, what is the wisdom in it? Because the world is made up not only of what is, but of what might be. And it's that idea, I read that passage from Perelandra because it's that idea that gets us to Narnia. This idea that the world is not only made up of what is, but what might be. This is how Lewis's fantasy world could be of any use to us. It presents us an image of what might be. Now, that's not the word might as in what might someday possibly happen, but it's the word might in a different sense. No, Lewis asks the question, what might a different world look like? In 1958, 2 years after the final Narnia book was published, Lewis made it clear that the Chronicles of Narnia were not Christian allegories. It wasn't this like one-to-one relationship, but they are, he called them supposals. So this is his explanation. If Aslan represented the immaterial deity in the same way in which the giant despair represents despair, does anybody know what the giant despair is from?
Pilgrim's Progress?
Yes, Pilgrim's Progress, John Bunyan. So that's this work of Christian allegory, right, where there's all these symbols and signs of abstract concepts. So if the giant despair, this character, represents this abstract concept of despair, then he would be an allegorical figure. In reality, however, he is an invention giving an he's talking about Aslan. He is an invention giving an imaginary answer to the question, what might Christ become like if there really were a world like Narnia, and he chose to be incarnate and die and rise again in that world as he actually has done in ours. That is not an allegory at all. So Lewis is trying to do this really unique thing. He's saying, okay, if you're reading Narnia, Aslan isn't representative of Christ. He's an imagined type of Christ for an imagined world. And he's one that helps us see our real Christ in a new light. Here's another quote from him. He says, let us suppose, this is where that supposal words comes from, let us suppose that there were a land like Narnia and that the Son of God, as he became a man in our world, became a lion there. And then imagine what would happen. So here's the central premise that we're going to start from, right? Okay, this is where we're starting. There's this imagined world. What does Jesus look like if there's a Jesus figure in that world? And then let our imaginations run wild. So, in that sense, Narnia doesn't answer questions about God. It provokes our own thought and imagination about God. This is Lewis at his best, I think, using Narnia to show us something without really arguing for it. He's relying on the power of his imagery and the narrative style to allow our imaginations to supplement what reason merely suggests. So, here's the big question. How did Narnia come about? In the first instance that we have where C.S. Lewis decided to write a children's novel was in 1939. Now, if we go back to that timeline, you'll notice that They weren't published until 1950. So this is a little more than 10 years before The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is published. In 1939, Lewis comes down to breakfast at his home, the Kilns, where he lived with Mrs. Moore and her daughter and his brother Warney. He comes down to breakfast and he says, "I'm going to write a children's book." And the two of them thought that was very funny because Lewis did not have any children, and not only did he not have any children, he very rarely even encountered children. Remember, what is Lewis doing at this time? Anybody remember? I'm really asking. He's a professor at Oxford, right? He is steeped in this academic world. He is steeped in the world of medieval literature and philosophy. This is not a world of children. And the other thing that we have to remember is that, in fact, Lewis hadn't even begun to write things like Mere Christianity yet, or the Screwtape Letters. This is 1939. This is a year before Mere Christianity starts to be done as broadcast talks, and 3 years before the Screwtape Letters are written. And so Lewis isn't even really getting into the whole idea of writing these abstract concepts for common people that he would really get into in the 1940s. And so the idea that Lewis would write a children's book just was funny to Mrs. Moore and Maureen, her daughter. He had just published the first novel in the space trilogy, Out of the Silent Planet, but again, that was written for adults and it was not a commercial success. The only contact he had with children at this point was his godchildren, which is Owen Barfield's children, and that was pretty minimal. It was pretty sporadic. But this idea of a children's story had lingered in Lewis's mind. Lewis says that it all began with a picture in his imagination, a picture of a fawn carrying an umbrella and parcels through a snowy wood. The image, actually, he says, came to him when he was 16 years old, and it never quite left him until he was 40 in 1939. And he comes to the breakfast table and says, "I'm going to write a children's story. And it's going to be about that image," which has been lingering for 25 years. Now, that was 1939. Lewis tinkered with it for a little bit, but didn't really start writing it for about 10 more years. It was 1948. When he really started writing it. Because remember, he had to finish the space trilogy, and then he starts getting into his apologetic works. He starts doing the broadcast talks. He starts writing. And so it's not really until after he finishes Miracles, which was published in 1947, that he starts to get back into this idea, okay, I am going to write a children's story. And over those 10 years, Lewis continued to dream up different images. And these images would eventually, he would kind of link together in a plot and a narrative. But it wasn't, Lewis didn't come to the Chronicles of Narnia and say, "I've got a plot and I know what I'm going to write." He wasn't one of the writers, a lot, especially that's popular today, where he's got the plot mapped out from beginning to end, from the very beginning. He's very clear in a lot of his correspondence that the way Narnia came about was these pictures in his head, the pictures of a fawn, pictures of a witch on a sled, and a picture of a lion. So this kind of creative process where these ideas or pictures would just kind of pop up seemingly out of nowhere, it's actually very similar to the origins of J.R.R. Tolkien's The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings. In a letter that Tolkien retold the origin story, he says that it came to him while he was grading papers for Oxford. And he writes, "On a blank leaf I scrawled," excuse me, let me read that again. "On a blank leaf I scrawled, in a hole in the ground, there lived a hobbit. I did not, and I do not know why. I wish I was creative enough that these ideas would just pop up into my head that would become these commercial million-dollar ideas." It is worth noting here that Tolkien did not like Narnia, like at all. He was not a fan. We talked a little bit, I think it was last week, about how Tolkien and Lewis, even though they had so much in common, were very different storytellers. How Lewis was more of a storyteller, and Tolkien was a world builder. He was a creator. And so for Tolkien, the Narnia, with its kind of like loose mythology in the background, and had lots of different influences, whether that was Greek or pagan or whatever else, there's lots of different ancient mythologies that are kind of influences in Narnia. he hated that. He just felt like it was too much from all over the place. It wasn't tight enough. The details didn't correspond and line up correctly. He's famous for hating the inclusion of Father Christmas in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. He's like, why is Father Christmas in there? It doesn't make any sense. Having this like children's story that is much more basic, and the fact that Lewis wrote it so quickly, it only took Lewis about 5 or 6 years to write all 7 novels, and Tolkien, I think we talked about it a little bit, it took him like 15 years to get through his stories, and he had such a time with the details. And so for Lewis to just get through it and not really worry about the details at all, I think irked him a little bit. But back to Lewis and to Narnia. As I said, it wasn't until after the publishing of Miracles that Lewis kind of shifted his mind back to a children's story. And so he began writing The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe in the summer of 1948. And he finished it during the following spring. He would go on to write the sequel, which was Prince Caspian, The Return to Narnia, in just a few months. And then The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, The Silver Chair, and The Horse and His Boy all came by the spring of 1951. So that's 5 of the 7 books written in just 3 years. Drafts of The Magician's Nephew began at that time in 1951, but he actually finished the last battle, the last story, before he finished The Magician's Nephew, which was clearly the one that he had the most difficulty with. All in all, he wrote all 7 books in just 6 short years, and they would be published from 1950 to 1956, 1 book each year. That's the original publication order. We're going to talk about this a little bit. Lion, Caspian, Voyage, Silver Chair, Horse and His Boy, Magician's Nephew, Last Battle. You should read them that way. We'll talk about it. But before we get to that, I want to ask the question then. Okay, we've got the foundation of Lewis's fiction writing. We've got, okay, here's kind of where Narnia came from. But now my question I want to ask is, what are these books all about? What is the Chronicles of Narnia? What is it all about? To answer that question, I want to go back to when Lewis first decided to write a children's story. That first draft, when he first started working on it in 1939, that he kind of left for like 10 years, he actually threw it away. He wrote, "It was, by the unanimous verdict of my friends, so bad that I destroyed it." That was the first draft of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Why was it so bad? And that's a good question to ask. We don't know. It's been destroyed. But I think there's good reason to believe that it's because the first draft of the book didn't have any mention of Aslan. And Lewis said at one point that the first, he kind of recollected when the first time Aslan came bounding into his imagination. He says when he first started writing, "I had very little idea of how the story would go. But then suddenly, Aslan came bounding into it. I think I had been having a good many dreams of lions about that time. Apart from that, I don't know where the lion came from or why he came. But once he was there, he pulled the whole story together, and soon he pulled the 6 other Narnian stories in after him." A little late, but there it is. I think this is critical to understanding these books. If you ask somebody to describe the Chronicles of Narnia, you might get the answer, 4 children travel to an imaginary world called Narnia and have adventures. And if you read just 1 or 2 of those stories, it might make sense. That might sound accurate. I'm going to cite Wikipedia here. I know you're not supposed to. I actually have one of my high school teachers here. He's probably really mad at me. But Wikipedia describes them in this way. "Set in the fictional realm of Narnia, a fantasy world of magic, mythical beasts, and talking animals, the series narrates the adventures of various children who play central roles in the unfolding history of that world." And on one level, that's true. That is what these books are about. But on another, I think it's really missing the point. This is also from Wikipedia, but that's not the point. This is a chart of all the characters, the main characters that show up in these stories, right? Even if you haven't read all of the stories, it's clear how disjointed these are, right? How disconnected these stories seem to be, because we're not used to series of books that all have different main characters. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense to us, right? So the first two books, you have the four Pevensey children. And then the third book, two of them leave and two remain, and then their cousin comes in, and then there's another student, and the villains are all different. The only thing that is tying all of these stories together, I think there's actually two things. One is Aslan, the lion. But the other is the world itself, right? It's this world that you're drawn into, especially as a child. This fantastic, fictional world of talking beasts and fauns and centaurs and battles and glory and kings and queens. It's this world. So this story, whether it's this one or whether it's Caspian or Silver Chair or Last, the whole thing, it's not about the witch or the wardrobe. It's not about the children. It's about the lion, and it's about the world. It is the world. We got to start with the world. The world is what draws us in. It's what draws children in to this book, and it's the world that draws, like, it's the world that draws the children and the Pevensey children, right? They come through the wardrobe and they find this fantastic world. So it draws them in, and it draws us in as the reader. We get drawn into this world, especially as children reading this book. We get drawn into thinking about a world in which animals can talk and in which there are beavers that are building these dams, and they're really funny, and there's all these characters and this world that we just could imagine in our head that is so different from ours, that is so has so much more life, and it draws us in and it enchants us. And the purpose in enchanting us is so that we might eventually not only fall in love with the world, but that we might fall in love with the lion, just as the children do. Before this book is even halfway complete, before they really even meet the lion, they've already begun to fall in love with the lion. And it's through that framework, through a love for this world and a love for this terrible yet great lion, that we begin to see our own reality in a sweeter light. That's the same reason that I would argue that you should read the series in the original order. So let's talk about it. Some years ago, HarperCollins, the publishing company that still holds the rights to all of the Narnia books, decided to start to publish them all in this chronological order. That takes the Magician's Nephew, which talks about the creation of the world, and put it first, and The Horse and His Boy, which actually happens during The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and put it after it, and move some things around. And the reasoning is because Lewis once wrote a letter. He got a letter from a fan, a child, a young girl, who said, "Hey, my mom thinks that I should read these like this, but I actually kind of like to read them in chronological order and where I can see the beginning of the world and everything else." And Lewis wrote her back and said, essentially said, "You know what? I wrote them in that order, but I actually like your order better." And from that letter, HarperCollins, if you pull up open this book, the first page, I guess it's about three pages in. It's on the opposite side of the two Lucy Barfield, who was that daughter of Owen Barfield. On the opposite side there, under that big Narnia heading, you'll see this: "Although The Magician's Nephew was written several years after C.S. Lewis first began The Chronicles of Narnia, he wanted it to be read as the first book in the series. HarperCollins is happy to present these books in the order in which Professor Lewis preferred." I think it's a stretch. I think it's a stretch to say that this is the order C.S. Lewis wanted them read, when he already wrote them and published them in a different order. So I'm not convinced by that. But primarily, here's what I would like to do, just briefly. This is the chronological order, and I do understand that there are some people who like to have things neat and tidy, and this makes a lot of sense to them, and I think people should just be reading Narnia. So you know what, if you're gonna read Narnia that way, it's better than not reading it, it's fine. But the way in which the world unfolds in the original publication order, I think, is the way that we are meant to be introduced to this world and introduced to this imagined Christ. It's the lion and the world that capture our heart's love. And in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, we see this mystery unfold. Aslan is just briefly mentioned. In fact, the title is The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, but we don't get any hint of a lion until chapter 8, chapter 7, about 70 pages in. There's this mystery of who is this mysterious figure of Aslan, and what is this world? As the children in themselves, the world itself is mysterious. When you start with the magician's nephew, the mystery is gone. You've already been introduced to him. So beginning with a sentence like, let's see, I think it's on page 74. And the beaver tells them that Aslan is on the move. And now a very curious thing happened. None of the children knew who Aslan was any more than you do. But the moment the beaver had spoken these words, everyone felt quite different. Perhaps it has sometimes happened to you in a dream that someone says something which you don't understand, but in the dream it feels as if it had some enormous meaning. Either a terrifying one, which turns the whole dream into a nightmare, or else a lovely meaning, too lovely to put into words, which makes the dream so beautiful that you remember it all your life and are always wishing you could get into that dream again. It was like that now. At the name of Aslan, each one of the children felt something jump in its inside. Edmund felt a sensation of mysterious horror. Peter felt suddenly brave and adventurous. Susan felt as if some delicious smell or some delightful strain of music had just floated by her. And Lucy got the feeling you have when you wake up in the morning and realize it is the beginning of the holidays or the beginning of summer. This is the way that you were meant to be introduced to this new Christ figure. This mysterious way. And I think, here's the other thing. Magician's Nephew, some people really like it. It's one of the weaker ones. So, like, and The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is top two. I can't put it any lower than two. It's so good and it draws you in so much, and especially if you're going to be reading this to children, this is the one that is going to draw them into the world. And The Magician's Nephew works best as a prologue later on. Okay, we get drawn into this world in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and then we want to know more. We want to know, okay, well, what happens next? What other lands are there around Narnia? How did Narnia come to be in the first place? But you gotta have that starting point where you dig in. So here's what I wanna do. For the next 30 minutes or so, we're gonna take a brief break, but before we do that, we're gonna have another quick discussion question. But what I wanna do afterwards is I want us to start to take a journey through these books. We're gonna look at each book one by one. And what I want to do is I want to say, okay, what if we look at these books not as the story of children, but as the story of Aslan, then what do these stories tell us? So we're going to do that in a minute. But first, I want to ask this question to one another. How familiar are you with Narnia? And what is, if you are familiar with it, what's your favorite book, character, moment? I know a lot of you have read at least some of the Chronicles of Narnia, and I know there are some of you who have not read any of them, and that's perfectly okay. I'm actually really glad that if you haven't read any of them that you're here, so I can tell you why you should read them all. What I want us to do is, if you have a copy of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe though with you, turn to page 6. The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe was published in 1950. And if we read this story as the story of Aslan, we see that Aslan is the suffering redeemer and the victorious resurrected king. But we start with an introduction to the world. The bottom of page 6, Lucy has just gotten into the wardrobe. Next moment, she found that what was rubbing against her face and hands was no longer soft fur, but something hard and rough and even prickly. "Why, it is just like branches of trees," exclaimed Lucy. I'm not going to do, like, voices, so it's, you know, I'm just letting you know right off the bat. I don't have any kids yet, so I haven't had any practice, you know? And then she saw that there was a light ahead of her. Not a few inches away where the back of the wardrobe ought to have been, but a long way off. Something cold and soft was falling on her. A moment later, she found that she was standing in the middle of a wood at nighttime, with snow under her feet and snowflakes falling through the air. Lucy felt a little frightened, but she felt very inquisitive and excited as well. She looked back over her shoulder, and there, between the dark tree trunks, she could still see the open doorway of the wardrobe and even catch a glimpse of the empty room from which she had set out. She had, of course, left the door open, for she knew that it is a very silly thing to shut oneself into a wardrobe. It seemed to still be daylight there. "I can always get back if anything goes wrong," thought Lucy. She began to walk forward, crunch, crunch, over the snow and through the wood toward the other light. In about 10 minutes, she reached it and found it was a lamppost. As she stood looking at it, wondering why there was a lamppost in the middle of a wood and wondering what to do next, she heard a pitter-patter of feet coming toward her. And soon after that, a very strange person stepped out from among the trees into the light of the lamppost. He was only a little taller than Lucy herself, and he carried over his head an umbrella, white with snow. From the waist upward, he was like a man, but his legs were shaped like a goat's. The hair on them was glossy black. And instead of feet, he had goat's hooves. He had a tail, but Lucy did not notice this at first because it was neatly caught up over the arm that held the umbrella so as to keep it from trailing in the snow. He had a red woolen muffler around his neck, and his skin was rather reddish, too. He had a strange but pleasant little face with a short, pointed beard and curly hair, and out of the hair there stuck two horns, one on each side of his forehead. One of his hands, as I have said, held the umbrella. In the other arm, he carried several brown paper parcels. What with the parcels and the snow, it looked just as if he had been doing his Christmas shopping. He was a fawn. And when he saw Lucy, he gave such a start of surprise that he dropped all his parcels. And that is the image that C.S. Lewis, from which C.S. Lewis conjured up the Chronicles of Narnia. This picture of a fawn. And as a kid reading that, I can remember reading that passage. That's the first taste we get of Narnia, this strange creature that we don't recognize, carrying packages for Christmas, which I love because I love Christmas. And thinking back doesn't make a whole lot of sense because I don't ever remember reading about stores in Narnia, so I don't know where he was getting these Christmas packages from. But yeah, Father Christmas, right? He's not here yet. Shh. But this is our first taste, and this is from this we get Lucy, who falls in love with this world. And yet she comes home and nobody will believe her that she has found this world in the back of a wardrobe. But eventually she gets back, and not only does she get back to Narnia, but her brother Edmund comes with her, not intentionally. Turn to page 38. Edmund is a nasty little child who wants nothing except to make life miserable for Lucy. But they get separated, and Edmund meets this queen on a sledge, the second picture that Lewis conjured up when he was thinking of Narnia. And what happens in this encounter is interesting to me because right off the bat, we start to see how Lewis can create these pictures that we can very directly see some of our own reality in. And so this queen on a sledge offers Edmund his favorite treat, Turkish delight. The middle of page 38. While he was eating, the queen kept asking him questions. At first, Edmund tried to remember that it is rude to speak with one's mouth full, but soon he forgot about this and thought only of trying to shovel down as much Turkish delight as he could, and the more he ate, the more he wanted to eat. On the other side, at last, the Turkish delight was all finished, and Edmund was looking very hard at the empty box and wishing that she would ask him whether he would like some more. Probably the queen knew quite well what he was thinking, for she knew, though Edmund did not, that this was enchanted Turkish delight, and that anyone who had once tasted it would want more and more of it, and would even, if they were allowed, go on eating it till they killed themselves. It's a bleak picture in this children's story that we start off with. But we right away, we see this idea, what temptation and sin does to us, that we just want more and more and more of it. And eventually we see Edmund coming away from this encounter with this queen who has promised him more and more of this if he will just do her bidding, with a sickly feeling that even this one delight that he had so much joy in, that he wanted so much, left him feeling gross. Turn to page 74, if you have your books. Lucy and Edmund return back home again and again. The rest of the children won't believe them because Edmund's a big jerk and lies to them and says they were just playing a game. But eventually, all four of the students do return back to Narnia through the wardrobe. And they end up being met by a beaver, and the beaver is kind of turns into their guide through this place. And this is really the one of the first things he says to them. Actually, we already read this. I was gonna read this whole passage again, but we did this. Where they first hear about Aslan. This is where that passage that we read, the feeling that they get when they hear about Aslan, even though they know nothing about him yet at this point, right? So turn to page 85. Now the four children have gotten to the beaver's home, and they're really starting to understand what this world is all about. And they're hearing about this evil witch who had proclaimed herself queen and laid an enchantment over the entire land so that it was always winter, but never Christmas. And then the beaver mentions Aslan again at the top of page 85. "Oh, yes, tell us about Aslan," said several voices at once, for once again that strange feeling, like the first signs of spring, like good news, had come over them. "Who is Aslan?" asked Susan. "Aslan," said Mr. Beaver. "Why, don't you know? He's the king. He's the lord of the whole wood, but not often here, you understand. Never in my time or my father's time, but the word has reached us that he has come back. He is in Narnia in this moment. He'll settle the White Queen, all right. It is he, not you, that will save Mr. Tumnus." "She won't turn him into stone too," said Edmund. "Lord love you, son of Adam, what a simple thing to say," answered Mr. Beaver with a great laugh. "Turn him into stone? If she can stand on her two feet and look him in the face, it'll be the most she can do, and more than I expect of her." If you'll flip the page. This is just a great passage. Is he a man?" asked Lucy. "Aslan a man?" said Mr. Beaver sternly. "Certainly not. I tell you, he is the king of the wood and the son of the great emperor beyond the sea. Don't you know who is the king of beasts? Aslan is a lion, the lion, the great lion." "Oh," said Susan. "I thought he was a man. Is he quite safe? I shall feel rather nervous about meeting a lion." "That you will, dearie, and no mistakes," said Mrs. Beaver. "If there's anyone who can appear before Aslan without their knees knocking, they're either braver than most or else just silly." "Then isn't he safe?" said Lucy. "Safe?" said Mr. Beaver. "Don't you hear what Mrs. Beaver tells you? Who said anything about safe? Course he isn't safe. But he's good. He's the king, I tell you." And we see this theme. You see this throughout every single one of these books, whether it's when somebody first comes face to face with Aslan, or it's at the end of a story, or in the middle, wherever it is, we see it all over, where you see this theme of his greatness, his goodness, his mercy, and his wildness, his power. And there's this, you just see all over this, terrible and great. That's usually the way it's done, is terrible and great. At this point, they're still at the beaver's dam, but Edmund leaves. He sneaks out because he wants some more of this Turkish delight. And there's just this brief quote on 95 where Edmund sneaks out and it's then, now of course you want to know what had happened to Edmund. He had eaten his share of the dinner, but he hadn't really enjoyed it because he was thinking all the time about Turkish delight. And there's nothing that spoils the taste of good ordinary food half so much as the memory of bad magic food. And I love that if we're still thinking about Turkish delight as sin and temptation, this idea that the ways that we've corrupted good things often then just makes it unable to enjoy those things again in a really sad way. We're gonna skip ahead. There is so much good stuff in this book, and in particular the way in which Aslan is presented as this Christ figure, in which he sacrifices himself on Edmund's behalf. So he is the traitor, and Aslan offers himself up. The witch takes him, and he is mocked and derided and eventually killed. And it's this horrific, sad scene, but Aslan returns. And there's this quote where he talks about how there's this deeper magic than the witch really understood. That if a completely innocent person gave up his life for a traitor, then death would start working backwards, that the stone would crack and death would work backwards. But we're not gonna read through that whole scene. I gotta leave you something to read on your own here. What I wanna move to is just something that really begins to hit me. It's near the end of the book, 184. This is after Aslan has come back to life. Peter and Edmund and all these Narnians are off at camp, but this is right after Aslan has been killed and then come back to life, and Lucy and Susan are with him, and they've gone to the witch's castle. And earlier in the story, when Edmund went to the witch's castle, he found this courtyard filled with animals turned to stone, and creatures and giants and lions and centaurs all turned to stone. This was one of the witch's key powers, is that she could turn people into stone with her wand. And so now Aslan and Lucy and Susan show up at this castle in this courtyard, and Aslan starts breathing on creatures, these stone statues. And what happens next is, as a child, was very exciting. "I expect you've seen someone put a lighted match to a bit of newspaper, which is propped up in a grate against an unlit fire. And for a second, nothing seems to have happened, and then you notice a tiny streak of flame creeping along the edge of the newspaper. It was like that now. For the second after Aslan had breathed upon him, the stone lion looked just the same. Then a tiny streak of gold began to run along his white marble back. Then it spread. Then the color seemed to lick all over him as the flame licks all over a bit of paper. Then, while his hind quarters were still obviously stone, the lion shook his mane, and all the heavy stone folds rippled into living hair. Then he opened a great red mouth, warm and living, and gave a prodigious yawn. And now his hind legs had come to life. He lifted one of them and scratched himself. Then, having caught sight of Aslan, he went bounding after him and frisking around him, whimpering with delight and jumping up to lick his face. Of course, the children's eyes turned to follow the lion, but the sight they saw was so wonderful that they soon forgot about him. Everywhere the statues were coming to life. The courtyard no longer looked like a museum. It looked more like a zoo. Creatures were running after Aslan and dancing around him till he was almost hidden in the crowd. Instead of all that deadly white, the courtyard was now a blaze of colors. Glossy chestnut sides of centaurs, indigo horns of unicorns, dazzling plumage of birds, reddy brown of foxes, dogs and satyrs, yellow stockings and crimson hoods of dwarves, and the birch girls in silver, and the birch girls in the fresh transparent green, and the larch girls in green so bright that it was almost yellow. And instead of the deadly silence, the whole place rang with the sound of happy roarings, brayings, yelpings, barkings, squealings, cooings, neighings, stampings, shouts, hurrahs, songs, and laughter." Again, as a child begins to fall in love with this world and begins to fall in love with these characters and these talking animals, these beasts, the joy that rises up in them at seeing life now brought to these characters is immense, and it gives us a hint of the joy that we might have one day when the silence of death is replaced by the songs of praise. But turn a few more pages to page 194. Remember, this is not only the suffering Redeemer, the story of his suffering and his resurrection, but it's also of his victory. Aslan and the girls take that army and they go to meet Peter and Edmund and the army against the White Witch and her army. And they get there and we get this scene. "Off my back, children," shouted Aslan, and they both tumbled off. Then, with a roar that shook all Narnia, from the western lamppost to the shores of the eastern sea, the great beast flung himself upon the White Witch. Lucy saw her face lifted toward him for one second with an expression of terror and amazement. Then lion and witch had rolled over together, but with the witch underneath, and at the same moment, all warlike creatures whom Aslan had led from the witch's house rushed madly to the enemy lines. Dwarves with their battle axes, dogs with teeth, the giant with his club, and his feet also crushed dozens of foe. Unicorns with their horns, centaurs with swords and hooves, and Peter's tired army cheered, and the newcomers roared, and the enemy squealed and gibbered until the wood re-echoed with the din of that onset. The victorious king arrives with the long dead saints. And that's a picture that we have the same hope in. And for me, that's the power that these stories have. A reimagining, falling in love with a world that needs a victorious king, and then seeing the picture of that king appearing ready to bring his people home. We're not going to be able to read through essentially the entire plot of every book. But I do want to briefly look at these other stories. Prince Caspian is one of the weaker ones, but it's still very good. And I think the main message that we see here in regards to Aslan is that he is worth an enduring faith in an unbelieving world. In this story, this story takes place hundreds of years after the original one, and the children return just a year later, but time changes. Time is different in Narnia. And so they return hundreds, maybe thousands of years after The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and they find that this world has become grayer almost. It has become more dead, and it no longer has these same bright talking beasts all over the place, and there's no longer this belief in the old Narnia, the belief in Aslan and his kings. And so there's this story both of the country coming back to believing in Narnia, or believing in Aslan, but also of the children. And there's some really cool points in which they have to take some steps in faith. Lucy, the youngest one, who is always the one who is closest to Aslan, has to a lot of times kind of drag them along in the way that Aslan is telling them to go, because they can't see him yet, and it takes them some time to be able to recognize him, and they have to take some of those steps in faith. So there's some great examples of what faith looks like and how difficult it can be and how joyous it can be as well. The third book is The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, and this, I think, is a story of redemption, but also a story of the satisfaction for our longing. Let me read to you a quick passage from here. In this story, Lucy and Edmund return, and they bring their cousin, who is just this terrible boy, Eustace. And at this point, they show up and they actually land with the king on his ship, and they're all going off. You remember how we talked about you get into this point of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and then you want to know more. You want to know what's coming next, but you also want to know, well, what's the rest of this world like? And so in Caspian, we go back to Narnia, but now we go forward in time, but now we go not that much longer after Caspian, but we start to spread outward. We start to see more of the world. And so now the king and the two children and their cousin, they're on this journey across the seas. And so they find all these different islands with all these different, you know, just like different unique parts of these islands, whether it's these weird creatures, or if it's an island that you know, that gives enchanted sleep or whatever else. It's all these different things. But at one point they find this island, and Eustace sneaks off to be by himself to have his own little adventure, and he turns into a dragon. But there's this point in which he turns back, and so he comes back and he tells everybody what happened. He's now a human again, and he says, he finds that he meets this lion, and he leads him to this pool. And he's essentially, he gets the sense, okay, the lion wants me to bathe in this pool. But in order to bathe in this pool, he's getting the sense from the lion that he needs to undress first. And he's like, I don't have any clothes on. But he's like, okay, it's my skin. You know, dragons shed skin like a snake, right? So maybe he means I want to shed my skin. And so he starts scratching at himself and the scales start falling off. So I started scratching myself and my scales began coming off all over the place. Then I scratched a little deeper, and instead of just scales coming off here and there, my whole skin started peeling off beautifully, like it does after an illness or as if I was a banana. In a minute or two, I just stepped out of it. I could see it lying there beside me, looking rather nasty. It was a most lovely feeling. So I started to go down into the well for my bath. But just as I was going to put my feet into the water, I looked down and saw that they were all hard and rough and wrinkled and scaly, just as they had been before. So he keeps scratching. Okay, he says, all right, well, I've got another set of skin under that. He keeps scratching, keeps pulling the skin off. And eventually I thought to myself, oh dear, however many skins have I got to take off? For I was longing to bathe my leg. So I scratched away for the third time and got off a third skin, just like the two others. But as soon as I looked down, I knew it had been no good. Then the lion said, but I don't know if it spoke. You will have to let me undress you. I was afraid of his claws, I can tell you, but I was pretty nearly desperate now. So I lay down flat on my back and let him do it. The very first tear he made was so deep that I thought it had gone right down into my heart. And when he began pulling the skin off, it hurt worse than anything I've ever felt. The only thing that made me able to bear it was just the pleasure of feeling the stuff peel off. You know, if you've ever picked the scab off a sore place. Well, he peeled the beastly stuff right off, just as I thought I'd done it myself, only they hadn't hurt. And there it was, lying on the grass, only ever so much thicker and darker and more knobbly looking than the others had been. I didn't like that much, for I was very tender underneath now, and I had no skin on. And he threw me into the water. It smarted like anything, but only for a moment. And it became perfectly delicious, and as soon as I started swimming and splashing, I found that all the pain had gone from my arm. And we start to see this picture that Eustace can't pull this off himself, that he has to be cleansed, he has to be redeemed by the lion alone. He's the only one who can do it. And it's painful. It's painful for him to get this new skin, this new life. But it's worth it. He goes on to say, it would be nice and fairly true to say that from that time forth, Eustace was a different boy. To be strictly accurate, he began to be a different boy. He had relapses, but there were still many days when he could be very tiresome. But most of those I shall not notice. The cure had begun. So we get this cool story of redemption, of Eustace. But we also get this story of a satisfaction for longing. As you see, these sailors are longing for adventure. They're longing to find a land, something different. And one of them is Reepicheep, the honorable mouse, who is longing to find Aslan's country. But also the king is longing to find something new. And so there's a great story there of longing and Aslan as being the satisfaction of that longing. Lewis actually didn't think he was going to write another one after Voyage. And so he ends The Voyage of the Dawn Treader in this great way. I'm not going to read it today, but it's worth reading because he talks about how Lucy and Edmund have to go back. And Lucy is very upset because she says, it's not that we're leaving Narnia. She says, it's you. Is we can't meet you there. And he tells her that he is there, and that you have to learn to find him by a different name. He says that that's the reason you were brought to Narnia, is that you might be able to recognize me better there. And at the very end of the series, in the last battle, we actually see this quote from Lucy where she says, there was once a stable in our world that held something greater than the entire world, or something along those lines. And so you start to see, okay, Lucy recognized who Aslan was supposed to be in her world, which is cool. The Silver Chair is a story of Aslan that I think is best summed up, that Aslan graciously uses imperfect vessels for good purposes. In this story, Eustace comes back, but now he's accompanied by a fellow school member, Jill Pole is her name. But this story is all told from Jill's point of view. And the story really is about Aslan calls them to Narnia to do a task, to fulfill a task. And Jill is the one who is kind of given the point role on that task, and yet she continually fails. And yet they are successful. And Aslan is able to use them despite the fact that she is failing. And there's in particular, there's a couple cool places in which Aslan's words are compared to kind of like the law in the Old Testament is talked about in the Bible, how she needed to repeat the instructions that he had given her every night and every day when she woke up, much like the Israelites are told to in the Old Testament. But this is actually my favorite book, and I wish we had lots of time to dig into it. I really like this book in particular because my favorite character other than Aslan, Puddleglum, is in this book. And he's this like super pessimistic, but like thinks he's really optimistic character. But there's this great moment in which these characters are underground in this underground realm of this other evil witch. And she's trying to convince them that the world they know above ground, the overland, does not exist. It's not real. It's all a figment of their imagination. And so they keep trying to come up with things that are real and explaining them to her. No, this world really is real. This higher world really does exist. And so they say things like, well, we have the sun up there. And she says, well, what's the sun like? And it's like, well, it's this big light in the sky. And eventually she says, well, no, you're just taking what we really have, this lamp, and you're making it into something greater. You're imagining it that it's something greater. And they say, well, there's Aslan. He's a lion. And she says, well, it's a lion. And well, it's like a big cat. And she's like, again, you're just taking these things that we really have here, and you're imagining them to be greater than they really are. And there's this point, there's this like enchanted fire going at the moment that was kind of like making them all like, okay, well maybe she's right. And Puddleglum goes and he steps in the fire and talks about how there's this like burnt smell in the room and everyone starts to come to their senses. And this is what Puddleglum goes on to say. He says, all you've been saying, ma'am, is quite right. I shouldn't wonder. I'm a chap who always like to know the worst and then put the best face I can on it. So I won't deny any of what you said. But there's one more thing to be said. Suppose we have only dreamed or made up all those things, trees and grass and sun and moon and stars and Aslan himself. Suppose we have. Then all I can say is that in that case, the made-up things seem a good deal more important than the real ones. Suppose this black pit of a kingdom of yours is the only world. Well, it strikes me as a pretty poor one. And that's a funny thing when you come to think of it. We're just babies making up a game, if you're right. But four babies playing a game can make a play world which licks your real world hollow. That's why I'm going to stand by the play world. I'm on Aslan's side, even if there isn't any Aslan to lead it. I'm going to live like a Narnian as I can, even if there isn't any Narnia. So thanking you kindly for our supper, if these two gentlemen and young lady are ready, we're leaving your court at once and setting out in the dark to spend our lives looking for the overland. Not that our lives will be very long, I should think, but that's a small loss if the world's as dull a place as you say. And we again see this idea that we've seen all throughout Lewis, that we long for something greater, something that's beyond ourself. And it's that something that's beyond our reality that grants us hope, that grants us something worth living and wrestling for. The fifth story in the series is The Horse and His Boy. This story seems very disconnected to the other stories. It mostly takes place in a land that is not Narnia, but it really is a story of Aslan's sovereignty and his providence over the entire world, not just Narnia, but that whole creation. And the threads come together by the end of the story, which is really unique. The sixth book, or the first, if you're ordering them in the incorrect way, is The Magician's Nephew. And this is where Aslan creates this good world, but mankind introduces an evil to that world. But then Aslan gives mankind the opportunity to make amends, to fix it, to have a part in redeeming the world despite the evil that has been brought into it, which is really cool. And there's a fantastic scene of Aslan singing Narnia into creation, which is really cool. And finally, the last battle. And the last battle is kind of hard to read at first because it's depressing. Because this Narnia that you've come to fall in love with is broken. there's this great scene in it in which all of the talking beasts, they get told that Aslan is the same as this other god, Tash, from the neighboring country. He's the same. And they're like, wait, they can't be the same. Tash is this evil god who they sacrificed their children to. And he's not this good Aslan who we've always been told loves us and wants the best for us. And they say, no, he's the same. And there's this great scene in which all those animals are painted just with this great sorrow that this Aslan that they had for so long longed for and hoped would return was really just something worse. But the real beauty of this is at the end when this new creation comes. There's a couple scenes I would like to read to you before we leave. There's this point where the world ends. And Aslan is standing at the door where our point of view is. We're looking out into Narnia from this door. And there's creatures coming in from the door, from Narnia to Aslan. And they came rushing on, their eyes brighter and brighter as they drew nearer and nearer to the standing stars. But as they came right up to Aslan, one or other of two things happened to each of them. They all looked straight in his face. I don't think they had any choice about that. And when some looked, the expression on their faces changed terribly. It was fear and hatred, except that on the faces of the talking beasts, the fear and hatred only lasted for a fraction of the second. You could see that they suddenly ceased to be talking beasts. They were just ordinary animals. And all the creatures who looked at Aslan in that way swerved to their right, his left, and disappeared into his huge black shadow, which, as you have heard, streamed away to the left of the doorway. The children never saw them again. I don't know what became of them. But the others looked in the face of Aslan and loved him, though some of them were very frightened at the same time. And all these came in at the door, in on Aslan's right. And there's some great pictures of joy in this story. And they see this new place that they've been brought into is actually the same as the old Narnia that has just collapsed. It's the same mountains, the same rivers, the same castles, except everything seems to be a little bigger, a little more real. And at one point, this unicorn is with them. It was the unicorn who summed up what everyone was feeling. He stamped his right forehoof on the ground and neighed and then cried, "I have come home at last. This is my real country. I belong here. This is the land I have been looking for all of my life, though I never knew it till now. The reason why we loved the old Narnia is that it sometimes looked a little like this." This is the new creation that they were made for. And at the very end of the book, Aslan turns to all of them who are joyously celebrating in this new land with old friends and new friends alike, in this land that is more real than the last. And he says to the children, "You do not look so happy as I meant you to be." And Lucy said, "We're so afraid of being sent away, Aslan, as you have sent us back into our own world so often." "No fear of that," said Aslan. "Have you not guessed?" Their hearts leapt, and a wild hope rose within them. "There was a real railway accident," said Aslan softly. "Your father and mother and all of you are, as you used to call it in the Shadowlands, dead. The term is over, the holidays have begun, the dream is ended, this is the morning." And as he spoke, he no longer looked to them like a lion. "But the things that began to happen after that were so great and beautiful that I cannot write them. And for us, this is the end of all the stories, and we can most truly say that they all lived happily ever after. But for them, it was only the beginning of the real story. All their life in this world and all their adventures in Narnia had only been the cover and the title page. Now, at last, they were beginning chapter one of the great story, which no one on earth has read, which goes on forever, in which every chapter is better than the one before." And as a child reading that, coming to realize that the world that I did fall in love with is just the shadow of this real world, how much greater then can I look forward to the day that I will be in the world that I was made for?
Would you guys pray with me?